Colectivo Raíces presenta su programa
Espejos de Aztlán.
Información,
arte,
cultura.
Bienvenidos.
Cuando recuerdo los días lejanos de mi niñez, me envuelvo en melancolía, quiero ser niño otra vez. A solas con mi nostalgia comienzo a soñar despierto con los años de mi infancia y el niño que llevo adentro en el mágico momento.
Today we share the life of a child 70 years ago in Ojo del Padre o Guadalupe in Rio Puerco Valley. Dr. Nazario García tells us this story from the top down, how was life in rural New Mexico during the 40s. His new book, Oh, Heaven and Hell, My Boyhood in Rural New Mexico, just released by UNM Press, is a life trip through resilience, courage, and love of these Hispanic New Mexican families. My name is Cristina Bachín. Hoy compartiremos en Espejos de Aztlán la narración de la vida de un niño en Ojo del Padre o Guadalupe, en el Valle del Río Puerco. El doctor Nazario García nos cuenta desde abajo, desde los ojos de un niño, cómo era la vida rural en Nuevo México durante la década de los 40. Su nuevo libro, recién lanzado por la editorial de la Universidad de Nuevo México, Oh, Heaven and Hell, My Boyhood in Rural New Mexico, es un viaje de vida a través de la resistencia, el coraje y el amor de las familias hispánicas nuevo-mexicanas. Mi nombre es Cristina Bachín, para Espejos de Aztlán. Le damos la bienvenida al doctor Nazario García en esta tarde de Espejos de Aztlán. Thank you so much, Dr. García, for coming to our Espejos de Aztlán show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
The reason because we are so pleased to have you here is because of your just released book by the UNM Press, Who, Heaven and Hell, My Boyhood in Rural New Mexico, and I was so attracted by the title especially, and then going through the book, that I want that our listeners also can share your stories about your childhood, and particularly about living in this northwestern New Mexico area. Where was this childhood that you are narrating to us in this book?
Well, of course, I grew up in the Rio Puerco Valley, which is, for those who have not heard of the valley, it's situated about 50 miles southeast of Chaco Canyon. And I think anybody who knows New Mexico history, or even if you pass through New Mexico, know where Chaco Canyon is. So that gives you an idea. Another way to explain it is to say that the Rio Puerco Valley is situated approximately 45 miles northwest of Albuquerque as the crow flies. Mm-hmm. But if you drive there, it's going to be 76 miles.
Now it looks sadly as a ghost area because almost all the inhabitants are not anymore there, isn't it?
No, there are four villages. Okay, there are four villages. As one heads northwest towards Farmington, the Rio Puerco Valley actually starts, if you consider the river, the headwaters of the Rio Puerco, situated slightly north of Cuba in the Nacimiento Mountains. Then the river, as it carved through the terrain over time, and we're talking hundreds of years, or at least a couple of hundred years, it meanders. And the first village of the four is San Luis. The next village, it's probably about 6-7 miles down the road, if you will, is Cabezón, perhaps the most famous of the four villages. Then comes Guadalupe, which of course bore the name of Ojo del Padre. And then the last village, which is Casa Salazar, actually has no buildings whatsoever, but they're all ghost towns.
This story is particular because in this story you are narrating the customs and the everyday life of that town from the point of view of a child, from the top down. That how did that child see the landscape of that area? What were the colors? What were the smells of that time? ¿Cómo era el paisaje de esta zona?
Bueno, el paisaje para un niño, yo creo que en mi caso no era nada, digamos, excepcional, sino que para cualquier niño que ha radicado en el campo, ve las cosas, por ejemplo, ciertamente mucho más distintas de lo que sería con un jovencito de la ciudad, por supuesto. Now, to explain it in English, the landscape for me, and I talk about this in my book, the landscape was one aspect of my childhood that I found entertaining because it offered me the challenge to look at some of the volcanic peaks, for example. And I used to envision some of them because of their blue, the black color, as giant monsters, okay? And that's one example. Obviously, the Llano, which is the plains, gave me, as a child, a sense of freedom because as I rode my horses, and I had two horses, I had El Baito and I had El Prieto, and I was probably the only kid in the entire valley that had two horses.
And it was like having two cars.
Yes, and so the Llano gave me a sense of freedom, my horse. The river, the Rio Puerco, seeing it during the monsoon seasons in July and August, as it rained up north, and by the time the water flowed downstream, if you will, and close to my house, we as kids would go down to the riverbed and see the waves of this water that would rise about 8-10 feet. And we would dare the water to catch us, which was rather silly. It was dangerous also because if you trip, you're going to be drowned. And for me, the river was like a roaring bull.
Quiero volver a aquel tiempo como quien mira hacia adentro. Aquel tiempo de mi infancia, de soles y de recuerdos. Qué linda vida, volver a andar las distancias, caminar las calles viejas.
Your book has this title so attractive, that is Heaven and Hell. Let's begin with the hell. Can you tell just a short story about that, and then we'll share with our listeners a short story about the who, and then a short story about the heaven?
Well, we do it in reverse.
Okay, you choose.
because hell comes at the end of the title. When I was writing my memoirs, of course, you're constantly searching for a title because, in my estimation, rightly or wrong, I think that books, when people are browsing in bookstores, people are attracted by two things, the title of the book and the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. And they're not mutually exclusive in some cases, okay? And ultimately, I decided on this title, Ho, Heaven and Hell. And I thought, what are the implications of this title? What are people going to think? And in fact, I had somebody ask me recently, are there biblical implications here because of heaven and hell? And I said, no, let me explain. And that's what I'd like to do now. The hell portion or component in the title underscores and it dramatizes what life was for every Rio Puerco and in my valley, including my own family. Life became a veritable hell because, number one, most families and virtually all families were incapable of eking out an existence from the land. Okay? Why? Lack of water, droughts, horrible droughts. And those are probably two reasons. Okay? So it became a hellish existence for these people. And at some point, including my family, had to take stock of their present existence. And what do we do now? Let me at least, since I use the word dramatize, use my family as an example. My father, uneducated, fifth grade education. My mother never went to school. There were five siblings at the time that we left the Rio Puerco Valley for Albuquerque. So there were seven of us. And one day my mother and my father said to themselves, because my father, who had worked for the CC camps, for the WPA, or El Diablo a Pie, as it was called back then, no job, no education, no technical skills to speak of. So they loaded everything in an old car, very meager belongings, just literally the clothing on our backs, and we moved to Albuquerque. Life in the future was an unknown. So that was the hellish part of it. Now, if we can backtrack, heaven was that period when people were in ecstasy, if you will, because they were able to work the land, reap the benefits of their labor, planting corn, planting pinto beans and pumpkins and everything else that was considered part of their daily diets. And so when they were, shall we say, and no pun intended here, but if we say they were in seventh heaven, estaban en la gloria, mm-hmm. en la máxima gloria, they enjoyed that because they were dependent on the land and they were able to benefit from the land. But before that, we can also speak very briefly about the importance of the hoe, what we call cavador.
We are going to listen a little a short musical cut, and we ask our listeners to stay tuned because now we'll have the story about el cavador or the hoe. Listening, Dr. Nazario Garcia, in an interview about his last book, released by UNM Press, Ho Heaven and Hell, My Boyhood in Rural New Mexico. And we were just talking about the part of the ho. What's going on with that particular first word in your title, and how iconic is it on your book?
Well, of course, it's an important component, not only in the title, but also to convey the message to the reader how important this tool, this implement was for every farmer in the Rio Puerco Valley. If I may, let me just read very quickly the introduction to Chapter 30, which appropriately is called Ho, Heaven and Hell. Here's what I say. No hand farm tool among rural farmers in the Rio Puerco Valley was more important and symbolic of their hard work for survival and the kinship they fostered with the land than the hoe. In colonial times, this outwardly self-effacing implement was called an asada, lighter than the asadón, another hoe that enjoyed a certain popularity during that era. Now, to dramatize this, or at least to show the listening audience the importance of the whole, a few years ago I wrote and published a collection of poems that UNM published called Tiempos Lejanos, Poetic Images of the Past. And I wrote a poem about El Cavador, which I'd like to share with your audience. First of all, in Spanish. El Cavador. Todo sembrador reclama un buen cavador. Lo carga al hombro izquierdo o al hombro derecho con gran provecho. Con su cavador escarba, riega y hace soquete, es decir, lodo. Con su cavador defiende su querencia y honor. Con su cavador le mocha la cabeza a las víboras que se arrastran por la tierra o que andan de pie. En otras palabras,
it's a powerful tool.
In English, it reads as follows. The hoe. Every sower boasts his good hoe. He carries it on his left shoulder or on his right one with great aplomb. With his hoe, he hoes, he digs, he irrigates, and he mixes mud. With his hoe, he defends his homing instinct and his honor. With his hoe, he chops up the heads of snakes that slither on the ground or walk on foot. Es decir, el hombre.
Mm-hmm. And did you use the hoe when you were a child?
Oh, yes.
And how was it? The family, what was the time when you were using that hoe?
Well, of course, the hoe was... It came in different sizes. There was a hoe for my father.
And there was a hoe for a child?
And a hoe for children, for kids like me. And my hoe was small. But from a very early age, we were taught how to use the hoe. For example, when the corn plants started growing, they started sprouting in the spring, we as kids would accompany my grandfather or my father, and both of them would teach us how to weed the plants. When you plant corn, you would drop, say, 3 to 6 seeds of corn. And when they sprouted, if you were lucky, all 6 would come up. But that was too much because it would be too much competition with plants. So you would have to pull 2 or 3 of those. And then if there were any weeds around, we would use the hoe very delicately around the plant or to put soil around the plant. And so that's the genesis of how we learn to use the hoe.
Can we share with our listeners a day of your childhood?
It's more complex than one would think, okay? But let me try to simplify at least what my childhood was. But it's not simple by any means. It was very complex. And as I wrote about my childhood, one inseparable partner, if you will, was my mother. Because from Monday morning to Friday evening, we spent many, many months and years whereby the whole week we were by ourselves because my father was away working. Then he would come on weekends. So as we can see in my book, and the reader would learn to appreciate the fact that, just as an example, on Saturday and Sunday, when my father came home, it was a matter of my mother fixing food for him to take for the entire week. I would have to help my mother on Friday to clean the house, make sure that, because she was a very tidy person, to make sure it was spick and span. By Monday morning, my father is gone. That's wash day. Tuesday, ironing. And those 2 days, I hated because I had to chop wood. And on Wednesday, then came other responsibilities. And this is, of course, when I was in school. Once I started school, then my life changed because I would be away from home. But every day of the week, from Monday to Friday, it was like being programmed. There was something to do. The family responsibilities, tending to the horses, milking cows, feeding the cows, goats, the chickens. I had to go get the eggs from the chicken coop. Friday afternoon, I would have to, and this is a story that's in my book, my mom would say, "Hijito, hoy vamos a preparar gallina, pollo para tu papá." So I'd go out in the chicken coop and get a chicken. And I came, one day I came with a chicken and said, "No, hijito, not that one." I had this beautiful chicken. Said, "No, not that one. That's the one that lays all the eggs." And I scratched my head. I said, "How does my mom know that that's the chicken that lays all the eggs?" But the reality of a child being reared on a farm can be very traumatizing for somebody in the city. Let me give you an example. The first time my mother said, "Get me a chicken that we're going to fix for your dad," I got one, and I brought it to her. And she said, "Hold the legs, no?" And then you know what happens after that. Well, after she used the axe to sever the chicken's neck, I was so scared, I turned loose, and this chicken was flying all over the place. All over the place. And I couldn't understand that. And my mother said the following to allay my concern and the fact that I was really petrified. She said, "Hijito, en este mundo, para vivir, hay que morir." She was referring to the animals. And here's my mother, who married at 16, had me, I was the first child, at 17. And by the time she was 20, 22, she was the consummate example of wisdom. She knew how to deal with us kids, which is, to me, fascinating.
Yo a ese pollo le pregunto que si es gallo o una gallina, que si es gallo o una gallina, porque kikirikikea.
Kikirikiki, kakarakaka, kikirikiki, kakarakaka, kikirikiki. Kakarakaka, kikirikiki, kakarakaka, gomoki, kikirikikea, gomoka, gomoka karakakea.
During that time, how was the relationship between Spanish and English during your childhood?
Well, of course, living in rural New Mexico, we rarely came in contact with English-speaking people, okay? So there was not a problem. There was not a problem. And when I started school, I still remember my first grade teacher, Mrs. Montoya. And the first day of school, I took my tablet, my pencil, and my crayons. And the first thing when the teacher said, "Hay preguntas?" I said, "Yes." I raised my hand. I said, "Hijito, ¿qué pregunta tienes?" In Spanish. "Yes, what's your question?" I said, "Quiero hacerle punta a mi lápiz." Okay? And she said, "Oh, from today onward, we're going to speak English." The transition was wonderful. And of course, it was very difficult because when we moved to the city, I knew virtually no English whatsoever. I was 9 years old at the time. But if I may backtrack, I'd like to say something very quickly about my mother. There were no gender barriers in my family among my siblings, my sisters, my brothers. She taught me how to embroider. She taught me how to mend my clothing. She taught me how to put buttons back on shirts. And she did the same thing with my sisters. My sisters had to do the boys. And washing dishes in the kitchen was not something that was unheard of in my family. My mother would say, si tú comes en los platos, y tus hermanas también, entonces tú mereces lavarlos lo mismo que ellas. And she was very liberal in that respect.
Absolutely liberal for the time as well.
Oh, to me, amazing. She was so far ahead of her time and for such a young woman. And I remember one time I was spending time with my grandmother in Bernalillo, where I was born. And she was a curandera, and all of these patients would come. And at the end of one Saturday, I was so upset. And my grandmother came in and said, ¿Y qué estás haciendo, pucheros? Why are you powdering? I said, porque aquí solamente vienen mujeres. And she looked at me straight in the eye, and she said, hijito, bendito seas entre todas las mujeres. And do you know that that was an inspiration for me to put together a book that I published on Hispanic women called Comadres?
Gracias a esta abuela. Thank you, Dr. Nazario Garcia, for sharing your stories, your particular, your own story about your childhood with our listeners and through this book for which we invite our listeners to read. Oh, Heaven and Hell, My Boyhood in Rural New Mexico.
Cuando recuerdo los días lejanos de mi niñez, me envuelvo en melancolía.
You were listening to an interview with folklorist Dr. Nazario Garcia. You can have more information about his new book at unmpress.com. This was Espejos de Aztlán for you, Cristina Bachín.
Y el niño que lleva adentro en el mágico momento voy recorriendo el pasado aquellos años tan tiernos que el tiempo dejó de lado. Veo al gallegos de antaño, el pinche almacén del barrio, a Espartero con su fragua, Doimo su mulo y su carro, y a Capipe por las calles, deambulando, deambulando, y a Capipe por las calles, deambulando, deambulando.